Good evening. The United States grounds an aircraft built by a major defense contractor. California's governor shuts down Death Row. The college admissions scam. Is the system fixed? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with Heather Chin with the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019.
Yesterday, the British Parliament voted against Prime Minister Theresa May's second attempt at a Brexit deal. Then today, they voted to reject leaving the European Union without a deal, commonly referred to as a no-deal Brexit. This means a greater likelihood that they will now face a vote to delay Britain's departure from the EU beyond the current March 29th deadline. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans confirmed Naomi Rao to serve as 36th Circuit Court Judge in Washington, D.C., replacing recently confirmed Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The 45-year-old Indian-American woman from Detroit comes to the job from her role leading the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which Trump also nominated her for. Rao's nomination last November sparked controversy over her college writings about sexual assault, which some considered victim-blaming. Rao rejected the accusations.
In other major headlines of the day, Boeing's troubles continued, with the United States joining the rest of the world in grounding all Boeing 737, MAX 8, and MAX 9 planes. The action came via executive order issued by President Trump on Wednesday afternoon. The U.S. was the last remaining nation to keep flying the jet model, which is under scrutiny after its second deadly plane crash in 5 months. The October 29, 2018 crash in Indonesia killed 189 people, while the latest crash in Ethiopia killed 157 people. Here's what Trump had to say.
New information and physical evidence that we've received from the site and from other locations and through a couple of other complaints. We've had a very, very detailed group of people working on the 737-8 and the 737-9. New airplanes. We're going to be issuing an emergency order of prohibition to ground all flights of the 737 MAX 8 and the 737 MAX 9 and planes associated with that line. I've spoken to Elaine Chao, Secretary of Transportation, Dan Elwell, Acting Administrator of the FAA, and to Dennis Muilenburg, CEO of Boeing, and they'll be available shortly after our conference today. They are all in agreement with the action. Any plane currently in the air will go to its destination and thereafter be grounded until further notice. So planes that are in the air will be grounded. If they're the 737 MAX, will be grounded upon landing at the destination. Pilots have been notified. Airlines have been all notified. Airlines are agreeing with this. The safety of the American people and all people is our paramount concern. Our hearts go out to all of those who lost loved ones, to their friends, to their families in both the Ethiopian and the Lion Airlines crashes that involved the 737 MAX aircraft. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Boeing is an incredible company. They are working very, very hard right now. And hopefully they'll very quickly come up with the answer. But until they do, the planes are grounded.
The Federal Aviation Administration had spent much of the week defending their decision to keep flying the 737 MAX 8 model, saying it didn't have any data to show the jets were unsafe. U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao and her staff even flew on one of the planes to show their faith in them. However, after Trump's order, they stated that new evidence collected at the site, together with newly refined satellite data available to the FAA this morning, led to the decision. Boeing is the second largest defense contractor in the world. Its former CEO is currently Acting Secretary of Defense Patrick M. Shanahan, who is being probed for using his office to win contracts for Boeing. In September 2018, the company received $13.7 billion in Pentagon contracts to build drone tankers, U.S. Air Force training jets, helicopters, and more. Bill Hartung is an analyst with the Center for International Policy. He says Boeing has always had close connections to the government, a relationship that's constantly growing.
I think that could have been a factor. They didn't wait weeks and weeks, but they were the last to kind of wake up to the problem. So, a powerful U.S. company with ties to the administration, I think that certainly could be part of it.
Tell us a little bit about this company, Boeing. Its planes are iconic all over the world. They're considered the Cadillac of planes in a lot of ways. What is the role of Boeing in the United States?
The thing that a lot of people don't think about is, although Boeing makes airliners, they're also the second largest weapons contractor in the country. And actually, a former Boeing executive, Patrick Shanahan, is now the Secretary of Defense. So they get about $20 billion a year or more in Pentagon contracts year in and year out. They make some of the bombs that are being used in Yemen. They make fighter aircraft that have been sold to Saudi Arabia and other countries. They make attack helicopters. They're involved in making transport aircraft. So there's a whole range of things they do for the Pentagon. And now Patrick Shanahan has actually inserted a Boeing aircraft into the budget that the Air Force didn't even want. So there's a lot of influence peddling on behalf of this company in this administration.
The Secretary of Defense, he's acting right now, and the president just the other day, it was the president or his spokesperson was praising this guy to the hilt, but they have yet to really make him the full Secretary of Defense, and yet he's picking planes to be purchased by the military from his own former company?
Yes. There's a version of the F-15, which is a prior generation aircraft called the F-15X. And he's been pushing it since he's been Secretary of Defense. The former Secretary of the Air Force, who just left, Heather Wilson, said, we don't want this plane. We don't need this plane. Shanahan was criticizing Lockheed Martin, Boeing's main rival, which means the F-35, which is the sort of plane of this current generation. So basically he's cutting the Lockheed Martin plane. He's sliding in the Boeing planes, and he's doing it, as far as we can tell, against the wishes of the Air Force. And in fact, there's an organization called the CREWS. It's for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And they are filing an ethics complaint against Patrick Shanahan for this maneuver on behalf of the Boeing plane.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this company?
They've always had strong representation in Congress. So Henry Jackson, who was a very powerful conservative senator, would always go to bat for Boeing, whether it had to do with their commercial side or the military side of their business. And Washington State and the Seattle area were kind of the hub of Boeing's activities. There was a representative named Norm Dix, also from out there, who sort of played the counterpart role to Henry Jackson, but in the House. He was on the Appropriations Committee, and he was always inserting money for Boeing into the budget. It's shifted a bit now because they've moved a lot of their military operations out of Seattle. So they have a big factory in the St. Louis area that makes combat aircraft. They have big facilities in Southern California, including their top secret research facility. We know the facility exists, but facility that does top secret research. So they have a long history of kind of using Congress to do their bidding, often with the members who are in the districts where they have factories, where they create jobs using our tax dollars.
Yeah, do we have any knowledge of the roots of that, where it comes from, that close relationship? Was it in the birth of the company, the people who founded it?
It came early on. I think it was solidified in the 90s when they bought McDonnell Douglas, which was at that time one of the major contractors and the builder of a lot of the nation's fighter aircraft. So that just pushed them up a level in terms of their Pentagon contracts, their facilities around the country, the kind of money they could spend on lobbying and campaign contributions. So they shifted, I would say, in the 90s, even further towards the military side of the business.
Bill Hartung is analyst with the Center for International Policy. Meanwhile, Paul Manafort was sentenced to an additional 43 months in prison for crimes ranging from money laundering and obstruction of justice to failure to disclose lobbying work. Combined with last week's sentence for bank and tax fraud, he will serve a total of 77 and a half years in federal prison. That was far below the amount of time recommended by special counsel Robert Mueller's office for the man who once served as Trump's presidential campaign chair. Within minutes of his second sentencing hearing, though, Manafort was hit with new charges, this time by a New York grand jury announced by Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance. The indictment includes 16 counts ranging from residential mortgage fraud, conspiracy, falsifying business records, and scheming to defraud. If convicted, a presidential pardon, if given, would not apply to these, as these are state charges. Attorney and retired judge Bill Blum is a contributor to The Progressive and Truth Dig. He says unlike the previous judge who sentenced Trump's former campaign chair to almost four years, the judge made it clear that Manafort was deserving of the jail time he received.
7.5 years in prison when you're 69 years old is not a walk in the park. So I'm not upset with the total package. And I think that Judge Jackson today said a lot of good things to correct the impression that T.S. Ellis, the judge, T.S. Ellis III, the judge from the Virginia case, uttered during his sentencing proceeding that Manafort had led an otherwise blameless life. I don't know. Maybe it's time for Judge Ellis to retire. He's 79. He's on senior status, and maybe it's time for him to take off the judicial robes and maybe play some golf for the benefit of everyone. I think that Manafort is also now going to be subject to prosecution in New York, I understand, on 16 counts of falsifying loan applications. And it's a kind of a species of real estate and bank fraud. And that seems to be an effort by New York authorities to avoid the pardon issue that might come into play if Trump tries to pardon Manafort or commute a sentence on the federal convictions.
In other words, if he's pardoned, he could be just wheeled out of federal jail and right into a state jail.
That's what will happen, yes. The indictment's now been unsealed. He's going to have to be, he'll be tried, but those cases are put on hold while the federal sentence is served, or he could be tried while he's in federal custody. You know, he could waive time on the New York case. It will be interesting to see how all plays out, but I think that apart from the fact that New York thinks that these are valid charges, there's some thinking that this is a way to get around Trump's threat to wield the pardon power to get Manafort off.
Bill Blum is not only a former judge, but also an attorney who has represented defendants in 6 death penalty trials. He spoke with WBAI about reports Wednesday that California Governor Gavin Newsom issued a moratorium on the death penalty. The executive order effectively grants a reprieve to 737 inmates currently on death row, at least for the remainder of his term, which ends January 2023. Calling it the right thing to do, Newsom said the lethal injection execution chamber at San Quentin State Prison will be closed and the equipment removed. Newsom's decision reignites the national debate over capital punishment. Trump himself weighed in on Twitter, claiming the decision protects stone-cold killers. Newsom argued that there are innocent human beings wrongfully convicted and that he believes the death penalty is wrong. Blum says that the death penalty is an expensive luxury that, while making some people feel good, does nothing to deter crime.
It's a huge impact that it will have. There are 737 inmates on death row in California. I think there are over 2,700 statewide, so it's a huge percentage of the national death row population. And by virtue of Newsom's executive order, the death row population of California will all receive temporary reprieves from the ultimate penalty. Their sentences will, in effect, be converted to life without possibility of parole.
What does temporary reprieve mean? Could that be reversed?
Well, it could be reversed. As long as he's governor of California, it won't be unless he changes his mind. This is not a decision by a court, and it doesn't constitute a judicial finding that the death penalty is either unconstitutional per se or as applied. However, the governor has the power to grant reprieves, just as Trump has the power to issue pardons.
When was the last time someone was executed in California?
I think it was 2006 when Schwarzenegger was governor. We don't execute a lot of people, relatively speaking, in California, and haven't since California, since the death penalty was restored in 1976. However, prosecutors throughout the state have continued to file death penalty cases seeking capital punishment, and they've won many, many convictions, and that's why we have by far and away the largest death row in the United States. Texas, by contrast, will execute people. Florida will execute people. But California has been careful because we have kind of a, I would describe it as a kind of schizophrenic attitude towards capital punishment. On the one hand, we want to make sure that no innocent people are executed and that the process is free from racial bias. So we allow lawyers to explore the fairness of convictions, both on direct appeal and by post-conviction writs, in ways that some of the southern states don't. And therefore, we have this huge population on death row. So we have this duality here in California where district attorneys pursue the death penalty. The public is still supportive of the death penalty. But we are very, very careful once there's been a conviction to make sure that due process has been meted out. The modern system of capital punishment dates back to 1976 and the Gregg case, G-R-E-G-G, v. Georgia. And in that case, the Supreme Court constructed a system called guided discretion to carry out the death penalty. And under the system of guided discretion, jurors following a conviction of what turned out to be only first-degree murder, that was the only crime left for which a death penalty could be imposed, were to balance and weigh various statutory factors in aggravation and mitigation and look at the defendant's background and character to determine who among those who are eligible for a death sentence should actually be executed and who should be spared. That system was designed to eliminate racial bias and other imperfections in the previous iterations of the death penalty in the country. And I think it's been a colossal failure. It hasn't eliminated racial discrimination. You can see racial discrimination not only in terms of who gets sent to death row, but in terms of the victims of the crimes. If you look at who gets sent to death row, minorities are disproportionately sentenced. But if you look at the victims in death penalty cases, they are overwhelmingly white. So it hasn't eliminated racial discrimination, and it hasn't enabled juries to really weed out the worst of the worst offenders, sometimes people who commit, I don't want to call garden variety murder, but for lack of a better term right now, let's use that term, from those who commit, say, multiple murders, and who gets the death penalty and who doesn't. And it's a crazy situation, and the governor in California took a courageous step this morning saying that he was going to end it for those reasons. It's also tremendously expensive to administer the death penalty as long as you are committed to providing due process to the defendants. It's an extremely expensive process. And there's always the possibility that you have innocent people who are sent to death row and even executed. The Death Penalty Information Center asserts that 164 exonerations have occurred since 1976 across the country. So it's a really bold step that Governor Newsom has taken in showing some leadership. When you think about the death penalty and the political debates around it, you think about whether the death penalty deters murders. And deterrence theory really doesn't offer any good reason to believe that the death penalty deters murder any more than life in prison without the possibility of parole. If it did, you wouldn't have higher murder rates in the South than you have in many of the abolitionist states.
Former judge and death penalty attorney Bill Blum is based in Los Angeles.
Meanwhile, fallout from the nation's largest college admissions scandal also continued, with a leading New York lawyer being placed on a leave of absence due to his arrest in the college admissions cheating scandal that also snared actresses Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin. In a statement, the white shoe firm of Wilkie, Farr, and Gallagher cited what they called the widely reported charges against co-chairman Gordon Kaplan, 52. Kaplan and his lawyer declined to comment following a Tuesday appearance in Manhattan federal court, where he was released on $500,000 bond. More than 40 people have been indicted in the scheme that allegedly involved students gaining entrance to schools including Georgetown, Stanford, Wake Forest University, UCLA, and Yale as recruited athletes, regardless of their athletic ability, or on inflated college entrance exam test scores. Some deep-pocketed parents paid as much as $6.5 million, while most plunked down between $250,000 and $400,000. Author, teacher, and advocate Jonathan Kozol is famous for his books blasting American education with titles like Death at an Early Age, Shame of a Nation, and Savage Inequalities. Kozol says he's not surprised by the scandal, which is the outcome of an educational system that stifles the poor while grooming the rich for power and achievement.
It's rigged to start with in favor of the powerful, the wealthy, the orchestrating classes. It may be a crime in terms of defrauding the government of taxes, but the real crime is that every time one of these privileged students is able to buy their way into a prestigious university, they're stealing that seat from another child who may be very poor, maybe black, maybe Latino, for whatever reason, they're stealing that seat from a child who deserves it more than they do. We're never going to have anything like an honest meritocracy in the United States so long as this continues. And, you can condemn, and you ought to condemn, the agencies that perpetrate these frauds and act as intermediaries for the families. But the ultimate blame lies in the colleges and universities themselves. There's no way that the deans at these colleges could be totally unaware that this is going on.
Yeah.
And to make, one larger point, it's not simply this handful of people who've been able to buy their way into colleges. We've had legacy admissions for decades, for centuries, at all these prestigious universities. So, students whose families attended the same university for three generations, or students whose families have just built a spectacular new library, new science center for the college. They have an easy road. They just, unless they're totally incompetent, they walk right in. It's part of the entire panorama of gross inequality, which betrays anything resembling democracy in the United States.
Yeah, what is exactly the benefit of some of these colleges? I know they're great colleges, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, all of them. Yet there was a time I went to the University of Wisconsin. It was $250 a semester in state, and I got a first-rate education, second to none. And it was ranked above Harvard in political science and other. What exactly are people getting for all that money?
When parents spend as much as $50,000 or more to put their children into the most prestigious colleges in the United States, they may not be getting a better education than they could have gotten at a really good state university, like the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, or University of Michigan, Wisconsin. But that's not the point. They're getting connections. They're entering a social milieu in which, you know, the guy who lives across the hall, or the woman who's in the next room on the same dormitory, has parents who are going to introduce these young people into a world of opportunities, networks, job opportunities at the highest levels of Wall Street, for example. That's the ultimate prize that they're getting.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that the problem right there, that there's such a multi-tiered educational system where, depending on what school you get into, not your education, not the level of teaching that you're exposed to, judges what you can do and how high you can rise in our society?
Absolutely. It's rigged from the beginning, and it doesn't simply start when the student enters an Ivy League college. It begins much sooner. It begins when their parents are able to guarantee that they can go to a very expensive private school or a public school in a very highly funded suburban school district, which has, 12 AP classes and super sophisticated science and computer labs and two foreign languages, and the students learn to speak with an elegant French accent by the time they're in the 12th grade. Well, poor kids are getting half as much money invested in their public education.
Education activist Jonathan Kozol is author of numerous books on education, including Death at an Early Age, Shame of a Nation, and Savage Inequalities.
And closer to home, Hudson Yards is slated to officially open some of its buildings on Friday after 20 years of planning and construction. An interactive public plaza full of crisscrossing staircases dubbed Vessel, plus the mile-long shops and restaurants, will be first to open to the public. Still under construction are glass-bottomed observation deck, office buildings for the likes of Time Warner, HBO, and CNN, and a high-end shopping mall featuring Neiman Marcus.
Marchers in this Sunday's Irish American Day Brooklyn St. Patrick's Day parade will include the first openly LGBTQ group to join the march in its history. The parade committee's decision comes on the heels of the Staten Island St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee not allowing the Pride Center of Staten Island to participate in their event. The Brooklyn Parade kicks off March 17th at 1 p.m. at Bartle Pritchard Square at Prospect Park West and 15th Street, and winds through Park Slope and Windsor Terrace.
And hundreds of New Yorkers rallied outside Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn to protest proposed statewide cuts to Medicaid. According to Governor Cuomo's executive budget proposal, $550 million might be taken, which protesters and elected officials say would harm low-income patients and force service providers to close. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and co-hosted by Heather Chin. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.